Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. As strong supporters of the American Kennel Club, we talk about everything from conformation to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between. Your passion is our purpose. Tremendous thanks to our sponsor, Royal Canin. Every day, more top breeders are choosing Royal Canin. Join the winning team. Okay, crew, before we get into today's show, I am super excited to tell you about something new here at Pure Dog Talk. We know breeders are the lifeblood of our sport. We celebrate and honor our master breeders. So we're bringing you Breeders' Voice. Breeders' Voice sits down with top breeders, sharing their secrets, how they got where they are, the joys, and maybe even the heartbreaks. If you haven't had a chance, click the Don't Miss an Episode button so you'll get these in-depth articles delivered free along with your podcast. Sign up on our Facebook page or at puredogtalk.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I'm very excited to be joined today by someone I have a great deal of respect for in the sport, Mr. Dana Klein. He's an American Kennel Club judge and longtime breeder of Great Danes. Also, Dana, I think you did a little bit of handling in your past, right?
I did, correct?
Absolutely. So one of our very popular up-and-coming judges, very successful in the sport. So, Dana, I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So give us what we like to call the 411. Your background as a breeder, I know you've been doing this since you were in juniors, right?
Correct. Since a very young boy.
Since the Great Dane was taller than you, is that right?
That's absolutely true. That was even beyond being a young boy. They were taller than I was.
So how did you get started?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was fatherless at a very young age. My biological father passed away and left my mother with six children. So it was difficult times, actually, and we had a basset hound that was on down the road and things like that. But I had a very good friend who was in the neighborhood, and I used to help him do gardening, and I'm a big gardener and a big landscaper. So from a very early age, I loved doing that and was also a fisherman. So, of course, a little kid in the summertime, to keep out of trouble, you figure out what your hobbies can be. So a friend who was a neighbor, and he was great to me. He was like a father figure to me. So we would go fishing, and I mean, that's where I would spend my days. 5 o'clock in the morning, I was in my shorts and no shirt and no shoes, and I was in the river and I was fishing. So sometime in the early 70s, that person who was my friend became my stepfather. He and my mother met, and they were each other's love for 48 years, and they both passed away now. But he was the person who really instilled respect for dogs and a love for dogs. And I have to say, in the beginning, I was probably a little bit resistant to the idea of having a dog, but it all changed one day when he said we were going to go look at a litter of Great Danes. He thought I should have a dog, and it would be good for me to take an interest in something, probably because he didn't want me to follow in the footsteps of my three older brothers, which gave him a little bit of trouble. So we drove about 3 miles into the country, and I was very uncertain whether this was something I wanted to pursue, but we drove up to this home, and these two incredible creatures came trotting out in a backyard with this horse-boarded fence, and they were the most amazing creatures I'd ever seen. And my life changed in that moment, and I knew that was the breed for me. So we brought home a puppy, and he wasn't necessarily a show dog, but I pretended like he was, and you couldn't tell me any different. He was beautiful from head to toe, as far as I was concerned. So he's the dog who started it for me. I did 4-H with him, and it was very competitive then. I lived in an area where there were many powerful professional handlers, and he wasn't good enough, but we practiced, and I then got a better dog and a better dog, and that's sort of my beginning. But that was probably when I was 11, 12 years old. So that was my beginning in Great Danes, and I've loved them ever since, but I've certainly dabbled in many other breeds, one which we share, German Wirehaired Pointers. That
yes.
was the second breed that I ever bred.
Wow. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that picture that you sent me, I was so excited. I was like, which one is it?
Well, she was actually spotted by me in the backyard of some people in Rockford, Illinois, and they had an Irish setter, and they noticed that he was bred by Jack Funk, actually, and they noticed my talent at handling and asked me if I'd want to show him, and took me to their house, and I saw her in the backyard, and I said, well, that's certainly a show dog, and we owned her together, and she was the first champion, I think, that I probably ever finished, or one of the first champions, and she was a mother of many, many champions, and the foundation of the German Wirehaired Pointers that I bred. So it was kind of accidental, but we did very well. We bred some very, very nice dogs through about maybe a 10-year period.
Very cool. Well, I love your story, and I love that you were in 4-H. It's another area we share. I don't know if it's cultural or what. We've sort of lost that in a lot of our dog kids. And I just love the 4-H program, and I want to give a huge shout out to it.
Absolutely. And it was so important as a young boy for me. I had my stepfather, who was great, but he was tough on me, I have to say. He walked into 6 children from having none of his own, and it was a real test. But I think he did the right things and certainly instilled upon me the importance of absolute care for the dogs and love for the dogs and responsibility. And I actually wanted to be involved in 4-H in that program because it was in a community where it was accessible and we had training classes and all those things. So it was a great experience, and it certainly gave me the confidence to think that I could really go out and do something with this dog, you know.
Right. I think it's that gave you the confidence. I've talked to a number of young people, older people, myself. It gave me something I could do that nobody else could do. That sense of confidence is incredible to me. So you talked also about living in an area you were in, Illinois, right?
Correct.
So you've got a lot of very well-known, very successful professional handlers around you. Who were some of your early mentors other than your stepdad?
Well, because of my love of Great Danes, my focus was absolutely in Great Danes, regardless of, I call it sort of dabbling around in other breeds at that very young age. Great Danes were my love. I absolutely dreamed at night about having, you know, fabulous Great Danes. It was always part of who I was. So it's ironic. I was showing a dog at a dog show that the woman had asked me to show. I went with my Siberian friend, and she packed me up in a car, and I went to the dog shows so my parents wouldn't have to take me every weekend. And a lady asked me to show a Great Dane for her. And she was, in my opinion, quite pretty. And a gentleman walked up who was a very, very prominent breeder, Rojan Great Danes, Ray Cataldi, walked up and saw me exhibiting this dog, which he bred, and he was like, where did he come from? You know, he's really good. So we instantly became friends, and I forever, till the day I die, will be a member of that family of dogs, and all of my dogs come from that bloodline, and Ray is probably, without question, had the most influence on me as a young person coming up, because he realized the potential in me and cultivated that and could understand my energy and, you know, put a cap on it when he thought it was getting out of hand or whatever. But he realized that it was all good and that my focus was to be really good at it, and I was devoted. And he taught me about the breed, and he sent me in the right direction where I was already going, but he just cultivated that and said, look, you got it, and you just need to polish it. So he being, in my breed, absolutely the person that I admire the most and thank the most for helping me along and helping me to be who I am and the respect I have in the breed. You know, early on, you know, Mr. Biven, we argue to this day. We have great arguments, but he's a dear friend, and he's another person that from a very early age saw the potential and saw the desire, and we've been friends, and I was friends with Irene before they were married. So he was a person that, even through my career, and then especially when you decided to become a judge, was someone who was very, very helpful and supportive and recognized that I was a person that was valuable to the sport, or at least that's how he made me feel. And Mr. Sabella and Mrs. Billings, I would not be where I am today without the advice those people have contributed. And I can't thank them enough, because they certainly encouraged me and believed that I was strong enough to stand by my convictions and that I wasn't going to bend and I wasn't going to compromise. And they saw that and encouraged that. And like it or not, they helped make me.
Well, you know, Dana, I have to say, if I could pick 3 rabbis in this sport, I'm not sure I could pick any better.
I feel the same way. Trust me. and we banter because we do, and it's part of who we are. And I think that he sometimes instigates it because he likes to hear what I have to say, and he likes to bring out that bit of feistiness that's in me when it comes to my breed or a breed that I know well. And I think it's a learning process for both of us. I think that we both understand that we continue to learn on a daily basis. And the minute that you stop that, everything stops. So all possibilities stop when you decide that you know enough. And that's never been my sense. I learn every day that I walk in and judge something, a class of dogs. I learn or hope to learn something, and I'm open to learn something. And that's a gift to be able to continue to learn like that and not shut it off. So he was one of the people instrumental. That, you know, we learn every day.
Well, and I believe in that wholeheartedly. That's what Pure Dog Talk is all about, is helping other people, sharing that wealth of knowledge that you have, that you gain from your mentors, and sharing it with people who might not otherwise get a chance to sit down and talk dogs with you.
The sport has certainly changed, and the unfortunate part about that is there are those of us who lived in a time where our sport was greatness. There was no question. It was a great sport. It still is a great sport. But being around with the big kennels and the big breeders and the opportunities were just endless. When I was a young guy coming up in dogs, there were so many people. And it's a little different now. So you have to pay it forward a bit and try and share that with people. It's not the same as living it, but there is something there to bring forward, and hopefully you can accomplish that.
And that's what we're here for. This is 20th century knowledge in a 21st century way. That's our goal here.
Right.
So let's talk about judging. You handled for a number of years, and when did you start judging?
Well, I handled and juggled that with a real-time job, which I had always. I was in sales and management for years, so I handled mostly Great Danes exclusively, and then I decided, not that they were boring, but I saw an income and I saw an interest, so I handled probably for the better part of 20 years, probably, yeah. Professionally, I was active every weekend. I mean, I didn't miss a dog show, and I took off work whenever I could. But I started judging, I think I'm coming on 20 years. No, actually, I think from my first application, which was 1998. So I'm coming on just about 20 years.
So in your life working with dogs, you've seen great ones and you've seen good ones. And we talk a little bit about this with a lot of our guests, and I always am fascinated to hear what to you makes a great dog versus a good dog and why.
Well, I am all about my breed especially, and I'll speak for my breed, and I think it probably is across the board. But for me, a Great Dane to be great, type is essential. And I'll give you a little background of how I come to say this. Compared to other breeds, let's say, because I'm not an expert in all those other breeds, and I didn't live with all those other breeds, so I'm going to speak to something that I really know and what really is in my heart. And I feel that, and people disagree with me, I don't feel that you can say that a Great Dane as a working dog, because every working dog that I can think of, you can find a job that they have to do or a job that they're designed to do. And I always challenge people and say, well, if someone said, let's go watch the Great Dane do his job, I say, okay, well, let me know when that happens. Because a Great Dane was a guardian dog, is a guardian dog. I'm not going to say that they're not. But we have hybridized the breed. We have brought the breed along through the years to be an estate dog and a companion dog. So for me, I think you have to identify a dog. A dog has to be beautiful. In other words, the Great Dane is a statuesque breed that absolutely has to stimulate your senses. Otherwise, I don't find value in them. And let me give you a little example. And I use this in teaching people about the breed. And I think you're probably old enough, maybe. I don't know. I'm old enough to remember the old figure skating contest. And we would never see the compulsories, the figure eights. You'd never see them do that. Why would you not see them do that? They would all come up to the big house with the same score. They all had a 10 in the compulsories because they were all expected to do that right because it was not a big deal, okay? And in my breed, I feel, that when they get to the big house or when they get to the televised part of the competition, the artistic expression and technical merit is where you begin to judge. That's how I feel you judge my breed, and that is movement is only a tiebreaker, and a Great Dane must fill your senses and must stimulate you in its beauty. Its purpose is absolutely in its beauty. And people will argue with me about that, and that's just what I'm committed to. And I feel that way about many, many breeds. Now, an example I'll give you that's not that way, a Brittany. You've probably read the Brittany standard.
Yes.
It absolutely requires a dog to be of a medium size and to work all day long, and fancy is discouraged. So you can't say that every dog is on the same playing field. I happen to feel the impression they give you standing is what makes them great. And our breed has a beautiful standard. It builds a beautiful dog. So if you adhere to the standard and you interpret the standard, you're going to choose a beautiful dog if you understand that. And it is a head breed. There's no question about it. It's not everything. It's not all. But without a proper head, it can never achieve greatness. That's how I feel about it. So that's where I am with Great Dane. It's not the same way with all breeds. But that's the breed I love and the breed I'm dedicated to. And I feel that way about many breeds. But in particular, Great Danes are a great example to use, because if you want the dog that jumps the highest, it's not a Great Dane. If you want the dog that runs the fastest, it's not a Great Dane, or the one that does the weaves or the hurdles, any of those things. But if you want the dog that will win the beauty contest, it's the Great Dane, and it should be the Great Dane. So to me, that's greatness in my breed.
That's awesome. I love that. And I think one of the most important pieces of that is the passion. And I think that's what we sometimes lose sight of. And the passion for your breed is everything in my world.
Well, and you know what's interesting, Laura, is people who respect me and some that don't. But there's one thing that they all say, you can't be any other way. People can't expect you to be any other way because of the passion you have. So for me to be any other way and to see it any other way is just foreign to me. So it is. It's what you live by.
And it is why I respect you, because I share that level of passion. And I think that when we really get down to the nitty gritty of some of the people in this sport that make the most impact, that bring the most excitement or the most strength to the sport, you're always going to find that passion. And I have a lot of respect for that. So working breeds in general, I mean, this is the group you come from. And we were talking a little bit earlier off air about the almost misnomer or the random accumulation of dogs in the working group. But we're talking about, for the most part, large giant breeds. Judging them is different than it is judging toys or terriers or, you know, some other thing. So as a group of dogs, all the way from, as I said, the Neapolitan Mastiff to the Standard Schnauzer, what do you see? Do you see strength? What are you looking for when you're out there in that group?
Well, again, you know, you have to look at each dog and its individual requirements and hallmarks of the breed, always keeping the hallmarks of the breed first and foremost. And I'll use, for example, I now have Tibetan Mastiffs, and it's a real eye-opener because, you know, you go into the ring and show a Tibetan Mastiff, and it's very difficult for me, as having come from showing Afghans and showing Great Danes and showing Dobermans and showing Beagles, that this is not a breed that has much interest in being at the dog show. They should be sweet-natured, and they should be somewhat of a guardian dog, obviously, but they go in, and they'll stand there, and they may keep their tail up, and they might look at a toy for 3 seconds and then lose interest. But I think it all comes down to expectations. I think if a judge is good, they're going to, in the instance of a Great Dane, if you don't open yourself to be stimulated, you don't open yourself to accept the fact that a Great Dane is what he is standing on. That's not to say that I want them to move. I absolutely want them to be beautiful in motion, but it does not define the dog. And there are some breeds that does define them. we could all probably agree that if movement were the only essential element, the Siberian Husky probably wins the working group every time. I mean, you rarely see a bad moving one.
Right.
You might see one with big ears and round eyes and all those things, but you rarely see one that moves bad. So for me, I think a judge has to be open themselves up to accept the limitations, accept the expectations of a breed and breed-specific things. I often find Doberman judges to have expectations of Great Danes that are not realistic. They don't enjoy being fixed into a pose and standing there the entire time. It's a great big dog with, you know, 150 pounds on four legs that aren't all that big, and they don't always stop square and perfect. And there's a reason for that. You know, they have a strong background of sighthound, and they don't have the same interest. It's great when you have one, but that's not an expectation of the breed. Where a Doberman is watchful, that's not in our standard. Watchful and aware of his surroundings and always on guard type of thing, you can expect that from them, and you should judge them accordingly. We talked about Neapolitan Mastiffs. How do you even compare that to the majesty of a Great Dane or a Doberman? You cannot. Entirely different purpose. The movement is entirely different. So, you know, back to saying working is a word that gets me at times because there's such a diverse number of dogs. So I think in judging the working group, you have to be a good study on the hallmarks first and foremost and identifying breed type and the purpose of the breed. And you also have to be willing to accept, I don't want to say shortcomings, but performances are not all the same based upon the nature of the breed. So you have to be willing to say, I can't expect a Tibetan Mastiff to stand there and use his ears for a piece of liver. That's not their thing.
And I think that's so, so important for us as handlers, as judges, as breeders, to remember that the value of the breed-specific dog presentation in the ring, if you have a Tibetan Mastiff that's showing like a Doberman, we might have some question as to whether that's a breed-specific temperament.
Well, and you know what? It's always a bonus. I certainly am not going to knock a dog down. For example, there was a Great Dane that did a fair amount of winning, and it was not a dog that I particularly cared for. And it'll go nameless, but I said to judges, you know, if you award that dog a Group 1 and you come back to me and you say, I just gave a beautiful Great Dane the group, I'm going to say, don't talk to me. He might have represented your image of the breed the very best, but with the breed failings and the type failings the dog has, it's never going to be a good Great Dane. It's a Great Dane. There's no question. It's a Great Dane. And it's because it showed on its tiptoes. It stared at liver the whole time. I said, remove that benign element. I don't mean to say benign, but quite honestly, judging dog showmanship rarely enters into it for me, unless it's a tiebreaker, because it is what it is. So if you remove that element, would you notice that dog? And they're like, maybe not. And I said, well, that's where you judge the dog. You cannot add that as a bonus unless they have the other elements to go along with it. And that's, I think, what really is confusing, frustrating, certainly, for me and my breed. And I judge that way as well. I tolerate some misbehavior. They're dogs, and you have to tolerate that. And if the dog gives an adequate performance for you to judge it, and it's not the best show dog, it still can be the winner. And under me, it's likely going to be the winner. And I've heard people complain, did you see that dog? He didn't move correctly until the second time around. Well, you know what? It moved correctly. It may have taken it a little bit longer, but the lesson Mrs. Billings always taught me was, make the best dog win within reason and be forgiving. So it was a great lesson.
Absolutely. One of my favorite dog show memories was the Spinoni National that you and Mrs. Billings both judged different days. To me, that was some kind of heaven. So,
Yeah. I think we picked different ones, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, actually, you judged quite differently, but right, both very defensible in where you were going. So I was just fun. So talk to our listeners a little bit. This constant stream of owner handlers can't win, professional handlers are the devil. Can you help our listeners understand why and how and in what way that narrative could change?
Well, I can tell you this. I don't know, and I thought about it when I reviewed the question, and I thought, I don't participate in certain sports, so I'm not going to say absolutely positively, but there aren't many. I can say with complete confidence, there aren't many sports that allow a 12-year-old child or an 8-year-old child to compete directly with a 35 or 50 or 90-year-old professional in our sport. There aren't many sports that allow that. So that alone is an opportunity or to hobnob with those people all day long. You're with them all day long. There's not a better opportunity if you are aggressive and you are willing to learn. There are always people that are willing, I certainly am willing, there are always people to learn from. But you have to be willing to take advantage of that. And that doesn't mean go home after you lose your class of two dogs and go home and decide that you're not going to come back till next weekend. As a young boy, I stayed all day long, and I sat and watched breeds that I loved, and I love owner handlers. I mean, quite honestly, I love owner handlers, and I love that they are interested in our sport. And I think people who know me know that if anybody came and asked me for advice or help, I'd be more than happy to help them, because those are the people that are the future of our sport, and we need to keep them around. So that being said, I think that professional handlers, they are good at what they do. I mean, there's no question they're good at what they do, and they might be better at you or not. But I don't see any sport that allows a person to create their own dog or create their own individual competitor and take it in and compete and be successful like the ability they have in purebred dogs. I just think it exists, and I think that it's keeping the bar high for yourself and always being your own critic. I think that it's so important that people who are successful, they don't base their success on someone else and what someone else is doing. They're constantly aware of their own critique of their own dogs, and that makes them successful. And I think owner handlers need to realize that these professionals are A, willing to help. I don't think there's any question. And to say to the professionals, you better be willing to help, because these are the people that are always going to be present. It may not be this person, it may be a different person, but you know what? They're the lifeblood of our sport, and those are the people that pay everyone's bills. I hate to say that, but that's a fact. So I don't know how other judges feel about them, but I am absolutely in favor of owner-handler competition. However, I don't think that's where the bar should be set. I think that an owner-handler should reach for the top, and they should never think that they can't get there. And I made a statement back in Colorado a couple of months ago that every person that walks in the door at 8 o'clock in the morning should be able to dream that they could be a Best in Show winner today. And if anything interferes with that dream, then there's something wrong with the dog show. And there's something going wrong. That was my dream when I was a young kid. I'm going to go Best in Show today. But you know what? I'm okay if I win my class. I'll be okay with that. But you got to keep the bar high. And I think people talk about politics, people talk about all that. And quite honestly, I think it plays a very small part. I don't think an owner handler or a novice handler can necessarily blame politics, because I think there's a clear path for them to be successful. They have to want it enough, and they have to be willing to hang in there and keep the bar high. And I don't pay attention to that, I guess. And when someone says that, it just doesn't resonate with me, because I came up through the ranks as a not a real wealthy young man that had to spend every dime he had to be successful. And I'd like to call myself successful right now. So I think I'm one of those stories that maybe those people should look at and say, well, he did it. And he did it on a very meager income and opportunities and things, but I did it. So it can be done. So I think I'm living proof of that. I'd like to put myself where they are and say, you know what, I did it. And here I am. So why can't you do it?
So one of the things that you just said really struck me. I love that idea that we all should be able to walk in the door and say, any one of us today could be Best in Show. And if that's not true, something's wrong with the dog show. So if you were king for a day, what would you change about the dog show to make that a more feasible, realistic, likely vision?
What I love about our sport, and I will say that, you know, going to the AKC show is just an incredible sight to see all the people interacting. I mean, for the most part, people are excited. That element is just pervasive there. I think that course, it's a great competition, but you see all these people at different levels of our sport. I think some people accept the level, and that's okay too. I think that some people say, I'm not really interested in having a specialist dog. As a handler, I wasn't really interested in that. I was more interested in competing on a pure level in Great Danes, and that's why when I was a young boy, I'd win a class of 16 open fawn dogs, and I thought I was the king. I was going home. I didn't win a point. And I won a class, and I was like, yeah, I'm doing good here. So I think people have to start with making sure that they have a dog that is competitive on their breed level. You know, it's a process. For me, I don't know that I could change things. I only want to teach people and say to them, look, you can achieve that, but you have to want it. I think people have gotten a little bit lazy in dogs. I think that people have laid back a bit and say, you make excuses, oh, it's a professional handler, it's political, or he knows this person or that person. I don't really think that exists as much as people think it does. So I would probably say if somebody put me in front of an audience of people for one day, I would tell the people, you know what, set your standards high, set your bar high, and you'll be amazed what you can achieve, but you have to want it. There's a difference. You know, you have to want it enough. And that goes with anything. You know, you don't achieve high accolades and high levels of success by sitting back doing nothing about it. You just don't do that in anything. So I would say to people that, you know, all of that is possible, and it sounds rather simple to say, but I truly believe that because it's how I was brought up to believe that it's possible for anybody. And it may not happen as often as it does for someone else. There may be things that happen that allow others to be more successful. There might be lots of elements, but that does not exclude you, and it does not exclude a person that works really hard and sets goals and does it right. You're going to be successful, especially in our sport. I think everything is possible.
I love that. And you know what, Dana, that goes right back to the passion piece. And when we bring our passion, it gives us the desire. It gives us the I wanna, right?
Absolutely. And it's what drove me from the very minute I stepped out of the car and saw those beautiful dogs. And I thought, oh, I want to be holding onto one of those. It changed my life. That moment changed my life. And I thought, I wasn't necessarily into getting a dog. It wasn't all that important to me. And I looked at them and I thought, oh, gosh, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And it stimulated me, and it has continued to stimulate me. And I have seen hundreds and hundreds and thousands of Great Danes all over the world, and they still stimulate me. So it's how important it is to you and how much you're willing to give and how much you're willing to put into it, because it's hard work. And as a breeder, as a judge, as a handler, and I can only speak for myself, I worked really hard. And I continually was my own critic when it was the breeding program or as a handler, as a judge. I don't care about what someone else does. I only care about what I do. It's only important to me that I make me happy. And that sounds selfish maybe, but that's my job. I go in, I judge dogs, I am there, it is my day, and it is my day to pick the dog that I think is the best for the reasons that I think that, and tomorrow's someone else's day. And that's what I love about our sport, is that we have one opinion today, one opinion tomorrow, and they're all valid. Because
Absolutely.
Each individual has a right to express themselves. So, and it is, you're right, it's a passion. I mean, I can't think of anything else that would drive anyone to do this crazy sport, but passion. So it has to be a little bit of the unknown, you know, a measure of luck, a measure of ability, a measure of a lot of things, and a whole lot of passion.
Well, Dana, thank you so very much for your time. I have truly enjoyed our conversation, and I know our listeners will as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, crew, we're all continually striving for expert level, right? But over at Royal Canin, expertly bred, expertly fed isn't just a tagline. These guys obsess over purebred dogs and the perfect nutrition for each one of them. Royal Canin formulas are developed with your breed's unique needs in mind for superior muscle tone, coat health, and digestion. As breed experts, we know the right nutrition can unlock the magnificence in our dogs. And the best part is, so do the Royal Canin folks. And they're showing their support for purebred dogs every day including supporting your favorite podcast. So check out the Royal Canin Crown Partners Breeder Rewards Program. It's a major win for breeders. You can visit my.royalcanin.com to sign up. Membership benefits include 20% savings over in-store prices, quarterly rewards, free puppy kits, exclusive promotions, and a whole lot more. Check it out, crew. Okay, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. And Allison is going to talk to us about feet. Feet. We forget about feet. It's very important stuff. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good.
So, you know, I think just like with people, sometimes feet are the forgotten thing when it comes to our dogs and just different things that we may or may not notice. I've seen a lot of people walking their dogs, like just even, you know, everyday people walking on the street, and they don't really realize, you know, because they're wearing shoes or flip-flops or whatever, like how hot the cement can be or the black asphalt. But even at dog shows, like, you know, that dry grass that a lot of outdoor shows get, that can like soak up the sun and be really warm for our dogs. So I just want people like in the summer, in the warmer climate, to really be aware of how long they're letting their dogs walk or stand on a hot surface. And I use the wet towel method before I take my dog in ring. I even do use that at outdoor shows, partly because I do use the towel as a psychological thing for my dog to know when he's going in the ring, but also for that exact reason. So I can control the temperature of my dog's feet, especially as the feet are how our dogs cool themselves, right? So that you're going to help them cool themselves if you're cooling their feet at the same time.
Absolutely.
So that's half of what I wanted to talk about today. So the other half is for those people who live in a much colder climate where there's snow and ice in the winter, or maybe you're traveling to dog shows that are cold, there's lots of ice. And, you know, they use a lot of different things. They use different ice melters and they use salt. So I actually personally prefer that they use salt because at least I know what that is. Sometimes those ice melters, like, I don't know what that chemical is. I personally use salt, you know, in my own housing kennel at a minimum when I need it. You know, I always think a dog having a little bit of salt on their feet is better than them falling and breaking a leg, or better than me falling and breaking a leg.
Right.
But some of the things that we forget is that old adage, you know, it's like rubbing salt in a wound. So if you're somewhere, even, you know, I show a lot of poodles, so I have to be really careful, right? Because they have freshly shaved feet that could have a little nick or a scratch or just very thin layer of hair because the feet have been shaved so closely. And so whenever I get them inside, I just simply, you know, have a spray bottle with water, quickly just spray the feet and then just give them a little pat dry and they're fine. But I have noticed that there are people that don't think about it. Their dogs have hairy feet, but they forget that they've shaved out in between the pads of their dog's feet, right? And it's not even just is the dog's foot sore from the salt, but it could just be like a piece of salt gets stuck in there, like in between the pads of the feet. And then they're going to chew it out, and then that might make them sick, or then they've chewed a hole in their foot, right? So just be very aware, you know, remember that we wear shoes, I guess, is the nicest to say. And our dogs don't wear shoes. So we want to make sure that our dogs' feet are cool in the summer, no matter what surface they're standing on. And in the winter, just be really careful when you're in public places or maybe at your own home about the salt. And if you think your dog, you know, has come in contact with some salt or some kind of de-icer, to give their feet a little rinse and a pat dry. And I think your dog will thank you for it.
I think your dog will definitely thank you for it. And, you know, some of us have even gone so far as to use little, make it so that our dogs do wear shoes. And there are boots that you can acquire, little canvassy or different material things that you can put on your dog's feet when it's super, super, super cold and their foot's going to like stick to the ground.
Yeah, I think anything like that, you know, as long as your dog is used to it and tolerates them. Yeah, I think boots, there's so many different kinds now. There's almost, you know, a different kind for every dog and every kind of surface that they might be on. So those are a great option.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Allison. And listeners, remember, Pure Dog Talk 25 when you sign up for your Leading Edge Academy course with Allison, and that will give you a 25% discount on your class and we can buy you a cup of coffee. So there you go. Don't forget.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Thanks, Allison.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk, brought to you by the Aramedia Group, publisher of ShowSite Magazine, your home for purebred dogs.